if y'all want to speak to how, even in your all's time as law enforcement, you've seen the threats or the kind of things you have to deal with on a daily basis evolve.
Well, given the fact that all three departments, you know, are running on a, for lack of better terms, a skeleton crew. You know, I work the day shift in Clay City by myself. Randy works, you know, pretty much the day shift in Stanton by himself. And, you know, and Raw works, covers the county a lot by himself. So when the situation arises where one of the three of us, you know, are going to potentially be into a scenario where, you know, I'm not talking about your run-of-the-mill reckless driver complaints or stuff like that, but if you, you know, if we get burglary in progress complaints or domestic violence complaints, you know, we try to go together. And I know I get a lot of complaints, you know, well, I see a Stanton car down here in Clay City, or I see a Clay City car in Stanton, or I see a sheriff's car. You know, it's not that simple just to say, you know, I see a car here, or I see an officer there. It's usually, you know, there's usually a purpose for that. You know, we try our best to work together. Sometimes those situations, you know, are not ideal. And like I said, you know, we usually don't go two or three officers deep on a reckless driver complaint or something. But if it's something that could potentially lead to officer injury or, you know, a citizen or the victim of a domestic violence, you're going to see as many police officers as we can afford to send. And that's out of bare necessity. You know, I've got friends that work in larger departments. You know, I've got some really close friends that work in Lexington, you know, and they're all the time commenting on how in the world do you police in a rural community like that when you have to go to a domestic by yourself? There's 15 of us to go. I'm like, sometimes, you know, you get those calls and you look over your shoulder and there's nobody there. A lot of generations look at small town police departments and think, you know, well, that doesn't happen here. Well, you know, I used to think that growing up. And now that I am a police officer, I think, how in the world does everybody not know how dangerous this place is?
We just had a shooting here in the county not long ago. And the result of that was the officer was cleared because he had no other choice than to use deadly force. Even though the guy that he shot didn't die, he's still considered using deadly force. Well, the whole reason that he had to use deadly force was the lack of support that he had there. He was the only one there. Somebody got there shortly after the shooting happened, but he started off fighting with the guy, physically fist fighting with him, and that guy was outweighed him quite a bit and was quite a bit taller than he was, just kept shaking him off. And then he resorted to his baton, striking the guy, trying to get him down, to get him handcuffed, to get him under control. Then he resorted to his pepper spray. That didn't have an effect on the guy because he was so high on meth. Then he resorted to his taser. That had no effect on the guy because of the amount of dope that he had in his body. And there wasn't nothing left but his sidearm, and he had to use that to protect himself, because the bottom line on it all is we want our officers to go home every night safe. Every time they get in the shift, we want them to get in their car and go home to their families and then be safe. We're not going to get out here and shoot people and tase people and spray people with pepper spray and beat on them with nightsticks for no reason at all. That's not why we're here. You know, I don't think I would have been here as long as I have been, and that's 33 years, if that's the way I operate, you know. And the thing about it is, when you look at 1984 when I started, and now the differences are huge, huge differences in people that you deal with on that daily basis. Back in 1984, when you stopped a car at 1 o'clock in the morning, you know, there's probably going to be a drunk driver or somebody intoxicated on alcohol, and you're going to have to fight that person. Well, I would a lot rather have a fist fight with somebody that's on alcohol than I would have an altercation with somebody that's on meth or that's on heroin, because of the ability to be able to control that person. And the thing about it is now, back then, we dealt with drunks, with people drinking alcohol, and we could control them. Now we're dealing with people that are hopped up on heroin and meth, and it's gotten to the point to where you can't control them without using some kind of force. But the manpower and the resources to do that with are no better now than they were then, really. I mean, I don't know of an officer that worked in Powell County in the year 1989 that had a bulletproof vest or a high-powered rifle in his car. Nobody got that kind of stuff until the sheriff and the deputy were executed, were murdered in 1990, you know, January 30th, 1990, when they were, I believe it was 90 or it was 92. Nobody had that kind of equipment until after that happened. And now we've all got that kind of equipment. The resources of equipment is a lot better now through grants and things like that. But the resources of personnel to have out there on the street working is not even as good as it was back then. You know, they got the COPS grant that I filed for back when I was working for Stanton. And it we done real good as long as that stayed in effect. But as soon as we lost it, we lost those officers, you know, and went right back to square one. And we need to be able to battle these drugs and stuff to cut back on the rate of crime, on the rate of thefts. And I'll go as far as to say it again. Most child abuse cases that are worked in this county, especially sexual child abuse cases, either me or KSP one works them. And every time you turn around, every defendant will sit across the table from you, and you interview them, and you get to get them talking to you and telling you why, what happened and why it happened. And it's always got something to do, some kind of a narcotic.
Another problem that we have is, I think it was a few years ago, and y'all correct me if I'm wrong, House Bill 463,
mm-hmm. crippled us
with the penalties for a lot of these crimes. It makes it harder to put people in jail and keep them off the street from committing crime, and more victims when the state changes the laws that cause them to be able to get back out on the street a lot sooner. The no consequences that they feel like they have or no repercussions to breaking the law makes it easier for them to make, like I said, more victims when they do get out. They figure if they get charged with an offense and get right back out of jail, you know, there's no problem with doing it again, because more than likely they're not going to get no more out of the second time than what they're in there on the first time. So that would be a big help to have stiffer penalties to keep these people off the street. And people always talk about, you know, the cost that you incur in having someone in jail. Well, that's kind of a trade-off. It's either that or the victims.
You brought up a very good point there, and that's one thing you see a lot of time in legislation. I think it's set out, or laws for that matter, for, you know, the intended purpose is good, but oftentimes I think they fell short of looking at the full circle of the thing. And like you said, a prime example is the House Bill 463. You know, naturally they looked at the overcrowding of jails and the cost that was causing physical court cities and that kind of thing. And this is pretty much perpetuated, like we talked about, by the spurge of this drug epidemic. But then I don't know that they fully looked at what it done. Like you said, the pressure it puts on, additional pressures it puts on our law enforcement. And of course, that kind of brings me back to another thing. And it has to be frustrating from you all. I know in my office, many times I get calls of somebody in genuine need of something, but because of either laws or I'm restricted in how I can do that. And that really equates to what y'all can do. And I guess in y'all's defense, y'all have to get calls every day of somebody that needs help, but because of laws or what you're allowed to do, you're unable to really help that person. And is there any examples y'all like to speak to? I know y'all deal with that daily.
People get frustrated. For example, catch someone breaking in a car, stealing property out of that vehicle, if it's less than $500, you can't even put them in jail. You have to write them a ticket. There's a lot of things that you're not even allowed to arrest for anymore that you were allowed to arrest for. The amount had went up on a felony charge. When I first started, it was $100. Anything over $100 was a felony. I'm kind of dating myself, but then they raised it to $300. It's now $500.
And they tried to raise it to $1,000.
Yeah, they were talking about raising it to $1,000, but it's now at $500. But you know, just things like that that you used to be able to put thieves in jail to keep them stealing off someone else. But now you just have to write them a ticket so they can go steal off somebody else.
I think a lot of that problem also, our communities, the people that get up every day and go to work, are not involved in narcotics and committing these crimes. They look on law enforcement and the judicial process and blame law enforcement and the judges and the prosecutors for crimes that we can't put people in jail for anymore. All we can do is write them a citation, and for the amount of people that got a big break because they changed the drug laws and stuff, they don't understand that it's not the judges, it's not the law enforcement, and it's not the prosecutors. They have guidelines they have to go for set forth by Frankfurt. And they go by those guidelines, or they're in trouble. I mean, you know, you can't if somebody breaks in, the way it is right now, if somebody breaks in your house and steals $3,000 worth of stuff, and then they go break in his house and steal $3,000 worth of stuff, and then they go break in two more houses and steal $3,000 or $4,000 worth of stuff. When they get to court, by the time that gets indicted and gets before the grand jury, and they get to circuit court on that, that's one offense. That's not five. They don't get convicted of five burglaries in the second degree. They get convicted of one burglary in the second degree. So that means four out of the five people that are victims in these cases, they get no satisfaction. They get no closure, or whatever you want to call it, from the court system. Because when you go out and commit one crime, you might as well commit a dozen, because you're only going to get convicted one time. You're only going to have to pull one sentence for those five crimes.
I think we kind of, in talking about that, kind of another point that come to mind there, you know, naturally I think that nationwide, definitely in this state, we got hit with this drug thing and was way ahead of the curve. Like, you kind of going back to the example of House Bill 463 or some of these other thresholds y'all talked about reducing, you know, you can see the point why they done them. And I agree, I think I'm in agreement with most of their thought process that necessarily incarcerating every drug addict is not, we can't afford it. But what we talked about, like I said, there's the piece of the puzzle they missed. They took that ability away from you all, and then yet we're putting them out without giving them no help. So it's creating a double whammy. You know, the piece of the puzzle, like I said, if you was going to use a bill such as House Bill 63, you had to have the piece of the puzzle as far as rehab places or a institution to deal with the drug problem. And we're just now starting to see them catch up, I think, in a lot of instances with them trying to provide facilities and things. You know, we've had several years here where, like you said, they were getting out, but they were still back on the street. Y'all was dealing with them. So hopefully, until we can get some means of dealing with the drug problem, you know, the releasing them isn't good necessarily for that person, or definitely our law enforcement community, if there's not some means of getting them help in that interim.
Absolutely. And, you know, 463 was just a Band-Aid on a open incision. You know, they saw a problem, identified it. They come up with what they thought were the best solution, which we all know is obviously nowhere in the ballpark as being a solution. But, you know, the mentality was, you know, for, you know, all these misdemeanor offenses and most of your drug offenses, you know, let's cite these people to appear in court. You know, let's keep the crowding down in the county jails and in the state penitentiaries. You know, we'll cite them to court, you know, and we'll give them presumptive probation, blah, 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 blah.
Thanks again for joining us on Bridging the Gap today. Tomorrow, if you'll tune back in at the same time here on WSKV-FM, we'll be joined with this same panel where we continue this discussion. And we'll just jump right in where we left off today. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.